Welcome to the How and the Why. With John Barrett Ingalls. Exploring and celebrating the creative process and the creative purpose of authors, editors, and artists that make up and inspire the Black Hill Press family. Black Hill Press is dedicated to the novella. We believe a great story is never defined by its length. Let's get creative.
I'm John Barrett Ingalls, and today we are connected with John Fachette, the author of The Frontman. John, welcome.
Hey, man. How are you?
Good, buddy. Good.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I always feel like my intro, you know, you and I were just talking, and then all of a sudden I had to turn into this intro voice. I heard myself, well, now I'm the interviewer, and I have my interview voice.
Yep, and I just said hi to you again as though we just picked up the phone, even though we've been talking for a few minutes. So
it's great, but nobody knows
yeah.
that. There's no one,
nope.
I'm gonna edit out all of that dirty talk that we had before, so no one will even hear.
All right, sounds good.
So do me a favor, do us and you know, or the multitude of listeners a favor, and tell us a little bit about your book.
So The Frontman is a novella about two characters, Will and Leah, who are both in their 30s. Will has been a somewhat successful musician in the Brooklyn independent music scene for a while, but has never like achieved national success while he's kind of seen his friends, you know, continue to achieve further and further success. He's still just kind of stuck playing the same clubs in Brooklyn and Manhattan and stuff. So, but he hasn't given up his hope, and then his drummer gets pregnant, and that signals the end of the band. So he's now at a point where he's trying to determine what he wants to do with his life. Does he want to start a new band and, you know, continue to kind of take these chances that may not pay off? Or, you know, is he going to settle down and start a family like he's seeing all these other people in his life doing? And then we have Leah, who is a realtor that he meets, who is a little older than he is and kind of similarly going through this crisis where she doesn't really feel a passion for her work. She hasn't found a significant other to settle down with, even though her friends and her family are pressuring her to do so. And so she's kind of trying to figure out where she's going. And the two of them meet, and that's kind of the entry point for the story.
Okay. I personally relate more to the Will character, that creative who
mm-hmm.
is getting older and hasn't achieved the things that I imagined I would back when I was
mm-hmm.
21. But no, it's interesting because even the person that Leah, who's already, you know, successful and making money and has a good life, still isn't satisfied because there's some other part that she feels like she should have or she's missing. What was the inspiration for this story? Where did you come up with the idea?
Well, it was a bit of a circuitous path to the novella. How it all began was two of my friends, Nate and Lorenzo, who are producers, got in touch with me about potentially writing and directing like a low-budget movie. They were trying to put together this series of really tiny micro-budget movies that were set in different cities. And they had this idea, which was just a sentence about a guy in his 30s who's been playing in a band, trying to achieve success. The band breaks up. What does he do now? He still hasn't made it. And that was it. And it resonated with me on a number of levels. One being that I, am kind of a passionate music aficionado and used to play in a punk band when I was younger.
Really?
Have some friends who are in bands. Yeah, so I have kind of that experience to draw upon, which is why they got in touch with me. And then there's also just the personal aspect of the story, which is, being someone who has been trying to make it as a writer, filmmaker since film school. I'm in my early 30s now. So a lot of the kind of same emotions and feelings, even though it's different. I'm not a musician. The frustrations, the self-doubt, the anxiety, all those things, ring true and are things that I have dealt with in the past. And then I've also observed some people in my life who were musicians trying to make it and kind of almost getting to that level where they were going to break out, and it just didn't happen for whatever reason. So I think it's a much more common story. People who try to do something and either fail or don't quite achieve the level of success that they had envisioned for themselves, then, the kind of underdog story where you see someone who's struggling and then they, by the end of the story or the movie or whatever, they achieve great success. I think that is one in a million, and then you've got, 999,000 other stories where people go up against, these great odds and they almost make it, but not quite. And so
Right.
I thought that was kind of an interesting story to explore.
Well, yeah, there's kind of like a, I don't know, for me, it starts to feel once you enter into your 30s that there's this like,
Ticking clock.
like an expectation that the world has put on you to not even to be successful at the thing that you went after, just to be like successful at life, to like have your home and get your car and start your family.
I think that, not to, I don't mean to interrupt, but just going along what you're saying, I think that is where kind of the angle with Leah comes in is, I also know just as well that, someone who sets out with this idea that if I achieve XYZ, I'm going to be happy and I'm going to feel like I've succeeded. Whether that's their own standards, society standards, their family standards, they have this ideal that they're trying to live up to. And
Right.
sometimes when people do achieve those things, they find that they still feel empty, that somehow that hasn't solved all the problems. Something is still missing, and they don't know what it is. And I think that can be just as frustrating as having, a goal or a vision of yourself that you haven't achieved. Is, achieving everything materially, financially, I have all these things that society values that I value. Yeah, why is it that I'm still not happy? So life can be complicated like that.
Well, yeah, and like, and your happiness is going to be totally different from somebody else's, And then, I
Right.
don't know, I was listening to this TED Talk. I love TED Talks. I can't remember exactly who it was, but they were saying that we as a society, I think especially in America, have this, it's a happiness deficit, and we always put happiness beyond a certain goal, like, money is it. Once I make this amount of money, I'm going to be happy. Or once I meet that person and have that life, then I'll be happy. But because the happiness is always beyond that goal, once we achieve that, that goalpost moves back. So then you end up with that person. You're like, well, okay, I have this, but now I need something else because I don't know happiness. I can't recognize it.
We've
I paint this
externalized it
picture.
in a way instead of internalized it. The idea
Yeah.
that happiness always comes from without rather than within, that we're always striving for something that is going to be the solution to our happiness deficit rather than kind of looking inside and saying, well, what is it about me that would make me happy?
His will as a
Not to get too,
no, you're absolutely that. Hey, I wish I could live my life. I think your life would be easier if I followed that mantra. But that's what I'm learning in my 30s is where does my happiness come from? But as an artist, thinking about will, if there weren't that external pressure to be something, seeing his drummer, his ex-girlfriend, his first love, you know, pregnant and starting her family and moving mm-hmm. on, and feeling like I have to live up to this standard set by all of the people in my age bracket. You know, I live mm-hmm. in this dumpy apartment and I can't, you know, I have to be something more than this, instead of I play music and I love it and that's all I need.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough because I think the issue is that one can be happy and fulfilled with the circumstances of their life and what they're doing. But if they don't get external reinforcement, that causes doubt, right?
Right.
So, you know, if I'm happy living in an apartment and playing music and, you know, living month to month, essentially, but there's also a part of me that wants, you know, a partner or a relationship or something. And I look around and everybody says, well, you know, this is not the kind of life that I can enter into. You know, I want stability. I want X, Y, Z, you know.
Yeah.
Suddenly that creates doubt in one's mind because you're basically,
yeah,
you're saying, well, okay, so I'm happy, but there's something wrong with me because no one would want to live that life. Right. I basically the choice is embrace what it is I'm doing and the consequence might be a life of loneliness, or I try to, you know, reach for a relationship, but then I have to sacrifice my ideals or sacrifice the way that I'm living. And so I think, you know, for artists, that is a difficult, that's kind of a conundrum because, you know, part of growing is also being in relationships and being with other people. But I think too, it's very easy to compare yourself against others. You know, in Will's case, he's looking at kind of, you know, there are two characters in the story and in his life that he's kind of striving toward. One is, you know, Michelle, who is his ex-girlfriend and the drummer who's given up music and starting a family. And so he's, you know, questioning that in himself. Is this what I should be doing? And then he looks at Alec, who's another friend of his, who's become a very successful musician. And in fact, Alec, you know, is inviting Will to open up for him at a big show. And he's saying, you know, here's someone who's a little younger than I am. We came up together. We were both in the same music scene, and he's made it. He's achieved what it is that I see for myself and have always seen for myself. So it's this kind of, you know, this tug of war between those two ideals that he's trying to navigate. And a lot of it comes from comparing himself against other people, I think. I think that's his problem as a character, is that, you know, he's looking
for his truth in other people. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, you also wrote that, and it's not like blatantly explained, but
mm-hmm.
you have Michelle go back to playing music. So she sees Will kind of get back into it, playing with this new band and a new life emerging in him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there, you know, I read into it that there was a part of her that's like, I miss that. And she looks at him and says, wow, you know, you have this freedom to do that. And
right.
she has to go back and try it.
I think, you know, the point at which things get complicated is when you start looking toward success as your rubric. You know, you're thinking, I like to do this. This brings me satisfaction, whether it's playing music or writing or painting or singing or bowling or, you know, whatever it is that you have a passion for in life. You do it because it fulfills you.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the initial impetus is. You just get an interest in it, and it's something that you enjoy doing. And then there comes a point where if you become good enough at something, you start to think, is there a way I can monetize this? Is there a way that I can do this, you know, to put food on the table, to pay my rent, you know? This
right.
is what I want my life to be.
Some other
to not
job.
Not have to have this day job or, you
yeah.
know, whatever. Yeah, it's like, I love this, and I'm somewhat good at it. Can I be good enough at it to be successful to the point where it can become my life? And I think that is a is kind of like a difficult fork in the road to navigate, because suddenly your expectation for yourself and for your passion becomes much more complicated. Because whereas, you know, if you were just playing in a band, you know, in a rehearsal space or a garage, you get together every week, you jam. If you had a good time and you felt like you were playing to the best of your ability, that might be enough. But suddenly, if what you're looking for is external validation and, you know, and also just the stress and the pressure of saying, okay, well, I have to now tour 6 months out of the year and put an album out every year, and this is the only way that financially I can live, then your passion starts to become more complicated and take on this added dimension of it becomes a career.
Right.
And it all the attendant stresses of a career are now commingled with this passion that you once had that was very pure. So in Michelle's case, you know, leaving that world behind and starting a family, for her, I think, doesn't mean that she's given up her passion. It's like, I can still play music and enjoy it and not have it be a stressful thing or a thing that I'm dependent upon as a source of income. You know, I can have a family and do this and raise a child and still, you know, preserve my love of music. And I think that's something that Will has a hard time wrapping his head around, in the sense that for him, he kind of has this all or nothing thinking, which is it's a cognitive flaw, right? That's one of, actually, in psychology, there's like 10 common cognitive flaws that people have, which is a distortion in the way that you think. And it, you know, it traces back to self-esteem and confidence and all these issues, right? And one of those is this idea of all or nothing thinking, which is either, you know, either I'm a successful musician or I'm worthless, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't be someone who just performs music for the love of it. Now there is this added level to it that he has to maintain in order for him to feel worthy as a person. So I think Will is just kind of you know, I like the character of Will. He's not me, but I also feel a little sorry for him too, because I think he's a complicated person. It's weird talking about your character.
Yeah,
like
no.
Being,
but I mean, they are human beings, and
yeah,
you know, and I don't want to. How much of him is you? Like, how much of that do you experience in your life with writing or being a filmmaker? Or, like, I know now you're going to school to be a teacher and
mm-hmm.
passionate about that and moving in this new direction. Is there a part of you that feels like you're walking away from something that, you know, 10 years ago you thought was the thing?
Yeah, I mean, it is something that I guess I would say that this book was very therapeutic to write. And, you know, there was a catharsis in doing it for me, because at the time that Nate and Lorenzo contacted me, I had felt kind of burnt out on writing. I had placed too much importance on, you know, external validation and success as a motivator for writing. And, you know, I was just at a place where I really didn't know what I was going to do. I was a little lost. And the fact that they got in touch with me and they, you know, gave me this idea and said, you know, run with it. And I should clarify that, I guess, in writing it, it started out where I was writing a treatment for a script, which is kind of like a very detailed outline, and had been sending them drafts of that, and they really liked the direction I was taking things in, and just suggested as an exercise that I write a short story about the two characters of Will and Leah.
Mm-hmm.
And 6 months later, I sent them this novella. It turned out to kind of just gather steam, and I just couldn't stop writing. So it really invigorated me, this process. And I knew that at the end of the day, I would have Nate and Lorenzo to read it. So I had an audience in mind. You know, it wasn't like I was just writing in a vacuum. I did feel conscious of the fact that I have two of my friends who are very interested in this subject, who really want to read what I write. And that made me feel good. It excited me. And the process of
Did it give you was there a timeline? Did it set up a goal system for you to finish?
There was. It was the idea that, you know, we'd be shooting in like a year or something. And that timeline quickly went out the window because I spent so much time writing the novella, and then I spent a lot of time rewriting the novella. I mean, the novella in total was like a year and a half from when I started writing it to publication. So it was like 6 months for a first draft and then about a year or maybe even a little longer than a year of rewriting. And what I was doing was I was kind of alternating between writing a draft of the novella and then writing a draft of the screenplay. And the screenplay, which I never really cracked ultimately, I mean, and we can talk about that later if you're interested, but the screenplay really informed the novella because I would write things in the screenplay that weren't in the novella because the novella was much more, you know, about internal monologue and these mm-hmm. characters' feelings, and the screenplay had to have a lot more plot. And that's probably one of the reasons that it didn't quite work, was that it's a small internal story that is not very plot-driven. There are very few high-stakes kind of incidences in the story, and movies tend to need those to work. But some of the plot elements that I created for the script, I felt like were things that I liked, and I was able to bring them back into the novella. So it was a weird process of, like, you know, writing a draft of a novella, then adapting it into a screenplay, and then kind of like stealing from that screenplay and then fleshing out certain things in prose form in the novella. And it just went back and forth like that.
When you were writing both, did you know that your novella was going to be something on its own? Or was it still a tool to help you write the screenplay?
I'm trying to think at what point Kevin read it. I had finished the screenplay and was probably I had finished the novella and was maybe working on the first draft of the screenplay. I'm trying to think at what point he got in touch with me. It was just random that he reached out to me. He and Ryan Gaddis and I went and had a drink downtown and were just like catching up. And they were telling me about a script that they had written. And then they, you know, Kevin asked me like what I was working on. And I said, oh, I've just kind of finished this novella. And he said, that's weird because I want to start, you know, Black Hill Press. And he mm-hmm. pitched me the concept of that. So then I sent the novella to him. So there was a point at which I knew, okay, this is going to live on its own as a novella, and I'm still working on it. And I did spend a lot of time rewriting it after the initial draft that he read and said that he would publish. So I was working on that still and then working on the script. And I mean, I overwrote so much. This was the least efficient writing process that I've ever been engaged in my life. Because there's stuff that I wrote about Will and Leah when they were teenagers, like 8,000 words of that, which is a lot. Mm-hmm. 'Cause the finished book is, I think, 29 or 30,000 words. So it was like huge sections that I would write and then completely throw away. And I basically just explored every angle that I possibly could and with the characters. And,
well, I imagine that helps you, even though you had to throw it away, that you know everything about them because you wrote everything about them.
Yeah, it definitely at a certain point started to feel like, and I should also say that at the time that I was writing this, I was working a job that demanded a lot of overtime. And so typically what my day would be like is I would work like a 10, 12-hour day at work and then come home and then write at night and sometimes write until really early in the morning and then sleep like 2 hours and then get up and go to work.
Wow.
So, I don't recommend it, but it was my health actually at a certain point, I did end up getting really sick after I finished it. Like I was probably the sickest I've ever been. My body just kind of shut down. But it was an interesting process because it really did start to feel like I was, like, living with these characters. It was not efficient, but you know, like I said, as this kind of cathartic experience, it was exciting. I mean, I definitely felt really excited about the writing process and always looked forward to doing it every night. And yeah, huge chunks of what I wrote. I mean, I probably ended up writing, you know, 70,000 words of that 30,000 words is the published novella. So,
well, and then you also wrote it. I remember you telling me that you wrote it and through one character's perspective, and then
oh yeah, that
changed.
Was interesting. So initially, it was the first person dual narrative or dual perspective. So it was first person from Will, first person from Leah's perspective, and it would flip flop between those two. And then I wrote it, and it was first person present tense. And then I rewrote it, the entire story, as third person past tense. And then I ended up, what is published is this third person present tense for Will and then past tense for Leah. So I would actually like do in a complete draft where I was just changing the tense that I was writing in or the perspective. And that was another interesting thing, because there are certain paragraphs that will work really well from first person perspective. But once you change it to third person, you know, omniscient, it just seems weird. And so it was like, well, that doesn't work anymore. So I'd have to rewrite the paragraph. So that was a whole other thing that I forgot that I did. And
now, at what point did this is all before you started working with Kimberly, right? The editor?
So she started reading it when it was third person past tense, I think. And then I started working with her. And it changed less by the time I started working with her, but there were, I can't remember how many drafts she read, but probably three, I'm thinking.
How do you like that process of working with an editor? I mean, I know working on a screenplay, you have your friends and your, you know, people involved in the production read through it, but like having an editor who is solely out to fine tune your work and chop and cut and trim and, you know, mold it into something that might not necessarily be how you see it. Did you experience any challenges or?
No, I kind of wish that I had been more challenged, because I feel like Kimberly has a very light touch. She doesn't like to, or at least she did with me. And I don't know if it's because she just, you know, because of the content, and she felt like it wasn't quite her genre. I don't know what it was, but she had a very light touch with me, and she would, you know, primarily, I remember there were a few things where she would just ask questions and say, like, you know, why do you think this is here? And sometimes, you know, like there was one instance where it was some of the prologue BS that was, you know, Will and Michelle when they were teenagers, and that was excised. But then there was like another section of the novella that is kind of it is divergent. I mean, I fully acknowledge that. And yet there's something about it that has always felt right to me. And, you know, other readers that I've given it to that I trusted kind of confirm that as well, that there's just this point. And that's the point in the story with the Frank character. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, it's one of my favorite parts of the book.
I just feel like it, like plot-wise, it's not essential, but
no. But, you know, it's
thematically and emotionally.
But you know what it does? Like, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but like going back to what we were talking about the two, you know, Will and Leah, and being in the 30s and being at this place where they're struggling. Well, Frank is like the lowest end, you know, like that's there to set the barometer for, okay, well, maybe they don't have it that bad.
Well, yeah, and I would say, you know, like in screenplay parlance, it is kind of like a low point, because what you know, just to give some context so that people who are listening who may not know what we're talking about,
right?
There's a section in the novella where Will, who's the main character, he is at a bar drinking during the day, and he runs into his old roommate, whom he has not seen in like 8 years, I think. And his roommate's a little older than he is. He's almost 40. And this is a guy who's essentially given up on life. But at the time that they were living together, they had both moved to the city with these dreams, Will of being a musician, and he was, you know, in fact, achieving some success back then, and Frank, who wanted to be a cinematographer and crew and was just like crewing on movies as a PA. And, you know, what I felt like that section was about was Frank is the version of Will that just kind of gives up. If Will, you know, was up against this brick wall, you know, he can't get any further in his career, and he just decides, fuck it, I'm just throwing in the towel, I'm just going to be a drunk, and that's it. That's who he would have become. So it's kind of this moment where you see,
he's kind of on that verge of making that choice when we come into the book at the beginning.
Yeah. Right.
Of like, I don't know what else, you know. I don't want to go on tour and being the backup bassist for this band, and I have nothing else. So, you know, yeah. No, I loved it. And I loved that character. I loved how Will dealt with him, too. Now, before we go, I just have one more question.
Okay.
What are you working on right now?
So, you know, the experience of writing the novella really energized me and got me excited about writing again. And in fact, I've been writing in a much more disciplined fashion now. It's been really great. It was a really great experience that I owe everything to in terms of kind of giving me a second wind. So a friend and I co-wrote a screenplay in about 6 weeks that we're both really happy with, and we're hoping to shoot it this summer. And then on the prose front of things, I had a really strong idea for a follow-up novella that I wanted to write. I have the characters, the setting, the world, kind of everything. But there just wasn't a whole lot of plot, and I felt like I have kind of already done that with The Front Man, and the next thing that I do, I would like there to be a bit of a stronger plot. So, so I'm kind of working on this new idea that I have that I think will work out well, but it's in kind of the early stages. But I would definitely like to write another novella, or, you know, potentially it might work out to being something longer as well. I'm not sure right now.
Well, I look forward to it, man. I really like your writing, and you know, don't make yourself sick, but do whatever you have to, because you develop great characters. You know, everything's relatable, almost painfully relatable, and I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
This has been The How and the Why by Black Hill Press. I'm John Barrett Ingalls. The show was produced by Kevin Stanek and yours truly. The music is Mea Lua by Bossa Zuzu. I wanted to thank everybody for your creativity and your inspiration, and to remind you all to keep making art. Thank you.